Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and have you seen the New York Times 1619 project yet? It observes that this year, today in fact, is the 400th anniversary of the first African people brought to the United States in slavery. The ship that landed in Virginia 400 years ago today carried approximately 20 enslaved people. I'm not sure they know the exact number. And establish the central paradox of American history, a country founded on the highest ideals of individual liberty that perhaps there ever were, while denying that exact liberty or individuality en masse in the most direct and obviously contradictory way, mass enslavement and all the violence and loss that comes with it based on race. This afternoon on the station, the director of the project, Nicole Hannah-Jones from The Times, will be on all of it with that big picture. But the package also drills down on various specific aspects of how our news and issues today link back directly to the centrality of slavery to the American story. So right now we will talk to one of the Times journalists about her piece in the 1916 package. It's Janine Interlandi, a member of the New York Times editorial board, who has been with the paper since 2006, largely covering health. And to that point, her article is called "Why Doesn't the United States Have Universal Healthcare? The Answer Has Everything to Do with Race." Janine, thanks so much for joining us for this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Your article begins with a story about smallpox in the post-Civil War South. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. So at the close of the Civil War, the newly emancipated were dying basically in droves for want of basic necessities. You know, they didn't have enough food, they didn't have humane shelters, they didn't have enough clothing, and they also didn't have enough medical care. So smallpox was a problem that, you know, America knew about. We knew how to treat it. They hadn't discovered viruses quite yet, but they knew that quarantine was a good way to prevent spread. They knew that humane living conditions, having sanitary housing, was a way to increase spread, and they knew that vaccination could work. And so during the war, there was a small outbreak among the Confederate soldiers, and I think maybe even the Northern soldiers, and they applied those tools to stop the outbreak from becoming a widespread epidemic. When the same virus hit the newly emancipated communities, they did not employ those tools, and they allowed the disease to kind of spread and become much worse than it needed to be.
And you relate that to a general ambivalence that was attributed to white leaders at the time about African American health in general. And you cite historian Jim Downs and his book, Sick from Freedom. What was that ambivalence?
So the ambivalence was, and this goes back to before the Civil War, you know, throughout the era of slavery, which was white slaveholders wanted black people to be healthy enough to work the plantations. That was their definition of black health. They, once the slaves were freed, they worried about them being so healthy that they could upend the racial hierarchy. So they wanted them healthy enough to return to the plantations even after slavery, and they wanted them, their communities, healthy enough that diseases wouldn't spread from black communities into white ones, but they did not necessarily want them so healthy that they would become a political force or social force. So there was this deep ambivalence, you know, just down to the very core of American policy, and that echoed, you know, throughout.
That ambivalence, as Jim Downs describes it, suggests almost a conspiracy to keep African Americans unhealthy so they couldn't compete for work or political representation. Does that ring true to you, as opposed to like just a fundamental devaluing of black people's health, part of devaluing black people's basic humanity, and an unwillingness to spend money on it?
I think it's both of those things at the same time. And, you know, I think one of the things that reflects the ambivalence particularly strongly is this concept that emerges of extinction. So they explained this ambivalence to themselves, not as a matter of racism, but as, you know, through these fallacies of racial difference. And the height of that fallacy was, as the black communities were sick and they were dying, I think their mortality rate of newly emancipated black people was like 20 times that of white communities at the same time in the South. And as the death tolls were rising and bodies were literally clogging some of the streets in some of the cities, they explained that to themselves as a matter of biological inferiority. So it wasn't that the refugee camps they were forced to live in were near pits of open sewage. It wasn't that they didn't have enough nutrition. It wasn't that we weren't vaccinating them or providing them with proper medical care. It was that they were biologically inferior and basically, you know, allergic to freedom. And so they were dying off. And so there were these fervent arguments in Congress from the former slave states saying to provide any care or assistance to these people is wasteful and stupid because this is a natural biological process and they're just going to go extinct and it would be stupid to try to stop this. And that's how deep that, you know, that kind of understanding ran.
My guest is Janine Interlandi, a member of the New York Times editorial board and a contributor to their 1619 project, which observes that this year is the 400th anniversary of the first African people brought to the United States in slavery and the implications of that to this day. Her article focuses on healthcare and why the United States doesn't have universal healthcare to this day, unique or almost unique among industrialized nations, and that it has to do with the history of race in this country. So here's another example. Way back when, you write, the argument about dependence on government benefits came up. We hear that to this day. Of course, it was a big, you know, Paul Ryan thing when he wanted to cut benefits in the name of the budget. It was a big Newt Gingrich thing in the 90s when they had that big welfare reform. Do you have an origin story, kind of the dependence of recipients as a scare tactic?
I think that, again, goes right back to when they established the Freedmen's Bureau and the ambivalence that we were just speaking of. So there was enough push, I think, from the northern states and also from the newly emancipated themselves. So they became some of the first advocates for federal health care because they were being denied charity care. They were being denied, you know, just basic sustenance. And so former black soldiers who had been promised certain rations petitioned their leaders for medical care and for more food for their families. And that became some of the first advocacy towards this. And what else? Yeah, so I think that was kind of the beginning of all of that. In terms of the origin story, the pushback against that, again, happened in Congress where they said black people are idle by nature, they're lazy by nature, and it's actually, again, this biological difference that the best way to keep them healthy is to subject them to hard labor. And we former slaveholders know more about black bodies and about black health than anybody else, and this is what we're telling you. If you give them help, it's just going to breed dependence because that is the way they are biologically made.
And we did a segment last week, which was about all the ways when after it no longer became politically acceptable to say black people are idle by nature and things like that, that the rhetoric shifted to things like, well, we just don't want Americans to become dependent on benefits.
Yeah.
But sort of everybody knew who they were talking about.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things to me is, you know, I've reported a little bit on the Medicaid work requirements. And one of the arguments that comes up with that, people who support Medicaid work requirements will often argue that gainful employment is foundational to health. And that's not entirely wrong. If you have gainful employment, you're likely to be more healthy. But the relationship is actually goes the other way around. You need to be healthy in order to work. But that argument that working is the key to being healthy, it goes back again to the creation of the Freedmen's Bureau and the resistance against that.
And you're jumping way ahead of the historical narrative. But let's go there, because it was another interesting thing in your piece. The backlash to Obamacare, I guess it was part of, where Arkansas established recently a work requirement forcing nearly 20,000 people off their insurance plans. And of course, the work requirement for benefits, you know, are generally premised on what many consider a legitimate social contract was, if you want the rest of the American people, the other taxpayers, to pay for your health care or pay for your food stamps or whatever it is, you owe them to work in exchange.
Exactly. And it wasn't just Arkansas. Arkansas was the one state that I think was able to implement them before it went through the courts and it was stopped. But there are several states that are actually still trying to do that. And some of those are in appeals right now. So it's kind of hanging in the balance whether we'll have work requirements or not.
And I guess the number in your article at that point indicates the the implications of having work requirements. I guess we could go through all of these people and find out if they just, they didn't feel like working, so they gave up their health insurance, or if there were real obstacles to them working. But 20,000 people in one state losing their health insurance because of a work requirement means something's going on.
Yeah, and you know, there's enough research to kind of show and lay out that it's not that those 20,000 people all got jobs, and it's not even that all of those 20,000 people were ineligible because they weren't working. That all the research suggests, you know, and this has been done in the past, that when you implement these things, the most people that are kicked off the programs and that lose the benefit, the majority of them are actually working, but they're working in low-wage jobs where you don't have consistent hours. So maybe one month you meet the monthly requirement and the next month you fall short. Also, you know, if you don't have access to a computer or the internet, there's barriers to actually registering and logging these things,
or
the bureaucracy.
Off the books, if we're talking about poor people, we're talking about a lot of underground economy.
Exactly, cash labor, so those things, they don't count.
And how does that tie back to race, which is the point of the piece?
You know, I think that's a tough question to answer, and it's hard to speak to the specific motivations of the entities that are enacting these things now. And, you know, I leave it to the reader to make those conclusions. But I will say that, you know, the line back to where that began and where those arguments began is overtly white supremacist. So, I mean, you can debate, you know, what the causes and consequences are now, but you cannot debate that. That's a historical precedent.
You tell the story of the nation's first black female MD.
Yeah.
And you quote from her, who was Dr. Rebecca Lee Crumpler?
She was one of so many just different unsung heroes that I had never known about until I did this piece, and you know, we're never taught some of these things in school, which is unfortunate. But Rebecca Lee Crumpler was born a free woman. She's a black woman. And she got her MD at a time when it was almost impossible for any woman, a white woman, to get a medical education, but she did. She was born and raised in Boston. She practiced there, and at the close of the Civil War, she decided to go to the South. She was the only black woman doctor, I think, at the time, and she was certainly the only black woman doctor to work for the Freedmen's Bureau, and she went and she set up shop in Virginia, and she worked in these communities of newly emancipated people, you know, who were struggling, as I said earlier, against so many different, you know, illnesses and shortcomings in care, and not only did she get an MD at a time when it was impossible for black women to do that, but she wrote a book called Medical Discourses, or I think it's called Medical Discourses. And it's just a discourse on the burdens of black diseases in black communities, or the burden of disease in black communities. And, you know, while congressmen are arguing, you know, white congressmen are arguing vehemently, and I think even the New York Times and probably some other media outlets are kind of accepting this argument of extinction and biological inferiority and, you know, even the depravity of the black race as being responsible for the illnesses that they're dealing with, she did a very scientific study. And as I quote her in the piece, she said, you know, they seem to forget, they remember this when it comes to white illness, but they seem to forget when it comes to black illness that there's actually a cause for every medical condition and that they may have the power to actually remove those causes and create health. And so it was just, to me, there was so many different ways that the newly emancipated and then, you know, marginalized black communities throughout history pushed back against this kind of discrimination and exclusion from our healthcare system. But to me, that was just such an eloquent rejoinder, because this was someone that, you know, by all accounts should never have risen to that level. And she did, and she spoke powerfully and with grace.
My guest is Janine Interlandi, a member of the New York Times editorial board and a contributor to the Times 1619 Project, observing that this is the 400th anniversary this year, and in fact today, of the first African people brought to the United States in slavery and some of the ramifications for our country ever since. And her article is about healthcare. Then you get to the New Deal. Social Security, yay. Collective bargaining, yay. But
8-hour workday.
Ways without saying race that black people were excluded.
Yeah. So the way this played out was, by the time you get to the New Deal era, the former slave states wielded enormous congressional power through a Southern voting bloc that was almost exclusively Democratic and overwhelmingly and pretty overtly segregationist. So these were white supremacists in Congress. And they were so powerful and such a united voting bloc that you essentially could not get legislation through without their consent. And the two things that they did, the way that they kind of secured the racial hierarchy that was prevailing in the South at that time, and that was a hierarchy that had delivered all of the region's power and resources to them to the exclusion of former slaves. They created a system by which if you wanted them to sign off on a legislation or to support that legislation, you had to grant them concessions. And the concessions they sought were, one, states' rights. So yes, we will take all of these public progressive programs that provide aid to people in need, because the South was a relatively, you know, a very poor region for Black and for white. But you have to let us determine how to allocate those funds. You have to let us determine how to distribute those funds. And guess who they distributed the funds to, and guess who got cut out of the deal? We're talking about people that were white supremacists in Congress. And so that's how that happened, and that's how that played out.
A piece of discrimination history that I did not know, should have known, I guess, but didn't know until I read your piece. The American Medical Association did not originally allow Black doctors to join?
Yeah, so that was, I think it was basically through the local chapters. They allowed all the local chapters across the country to determine their own rules and regulations for who could be a part of the American Medical Association. But the consequence of that, again, was that Black people were effectively barred and were not allowed.
So it was in some states and not in others.
I think it was in most states. I think it was actually in the majority of states. But if you want to get super technical about it, it wasn't necessarily the national organization.
Right.
It was actually the state organizations. But they've acknowledged that, so I don't think it's really in dispute. Mm-hmm. The national association has.
And you describe, therefore, how lay people, sort of lay medical people, I guess, when formal education was out of reach, formed their own networks and systems. Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. There's like, you could do a whole book on it, and in fact, several great ones have been written about this, and I've tweeted out the links to some of those. So in the wake of this exclusion, you know, Black communities were not merely victimized. You know, they pushed back in so many completely profound ways. So if you look at just the lay Black community, middle-class Black women created an entire, like, national public health movement, you know, just through lobbying, through charity, through just progressive work, and they created this thing they called Club Women. It was, you know, like women from the National Society. I can't remember the name of the society, but, you know, there were all these different societies of middle-class Black women who were pushing public health initiatives and going into the poorer communities and teaching them all of the things that they didn't have access to kind of create health, because they didn't have access to doctors, they couldn't get into white hospitals, you know, and they went so far as to, there was an entire movement, like a Black hospital movement, where the hospitals were segregated and it was separate and unequal, which means the white hospitals were much better than the Black hospitals. Instead of accepting that, the Black community, you know, did all kinds of things to raise money and to acquire resources to create medical schools and to improve the Black hospital. So if we have to be separate, maybe we can try to be equal. And they did that just through their own labors and their own efforts. And that was in the lay community. If you look at the Black medical community, the doctors that were acquiring MDs through, like, the two Black medical colleges that they had access to, they were the ones that ultimately pushed back against the American Medical Association. And so it was this kind of, for the AMA, an unintended consequence. You excluded this group of people, and now they have created their own power, and now they are pushing for national laws that will support their own.
We're almost out of time. I do want to mention the Affordable Care Act, which you bring up in the article. And I remember when we were doing the show during the debate for the Affordable Care Act, and then when it first got passed, there were some guests we had who really lauded it as one of the major civil rights or, you know, racial equality laws of our era. It wasn't sold like that explicitly, but it really was.
Yeah, it's kind of, there's so many things I learned reporting this. This was not, and I've written a lot about Medicare and Medicaid, and I had no idea, but what basically happened was the National Medical Association, which was the leading association of Black doctors, you know, they led the charge pushing for not just Medicare. It had originally started as a push for a national health care system, specifically because Black communities were being excluded from the white medical system that had arisen. They didn't have access to, you know, employer-based health insurance as much as white people did. They were segregated from the hospitals. They didn't have as many doctors. There was just multiple ways that they were shut out of the system. And so for them, of course, they wanted universal health care, because that's the only way to make it equal. The American Medical Association didn't want that, because they wanted doctors to be in control of the healthcare system, and they didn't want the government taking over, another familiar argument. And so what happened was Medicare became a civil rights act, and it was actually through Medicare that hospitals were desegregated, because when you pass civil rights legislation that said you cannot segregate by race any institution that receives federal funding, okay, that's like one part. And then the second part is you pass Medicare, which gives every senior citizen in the country federally funded health care. That means every hospital in the country is going to be flooded with federal dollars. And when that happens, guess what? You can't segregate these hospitals anymore.
So do you see the Medicare for All debate now through that lens?
I think it's hard not to once you like learn the history, and there's still so much like I think learning that needs to be done. But yeah, I mean, I think, again, the line is pretty clear and pretty direct.
Janine Interlandi, a member of the New York Times editorial board, her article in the Times 1619 Project is called "Why Doesn't the United States Have Universal Healthcare? The Answer Has Everything to Do with Race." Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.